Welcome to Justice Studio Sessions. I am Marianne Moore, foundress of Justice Studio. During these sessions, we will be exploring the social justice themes that have emerged through Justice Studio's work, showcase grassroots activism, and deep dive into ethical and equitable research and consultancy methods. Stay tuned to learn more about the complexities of social justice and how you can turn your passion into action. Hello, dear listeners. In this episode, we are going to be talking about international tax abuse. International tax abuse covers so many important topics, including illicit financial flows, tax havens, and how all of these problematic financial issues can be solved through an approach which is based on tax justice. For this episode, we're really, really lucky to have Alex Cobham, who is an economist and chief executive of the Tax Justice Network. He's also a founding member of the steering group of the Independent Commission for the Reform of International Corporate Taxation and of the Technical Advisory Group for the Fair Tax Mark. And he's a commissioner for the Scottish Government's Poverty and Inequality Commission. His work is vast. It focuses on illicit financial flows, effective taxation for development, and inequality. His books include The Uncounted, Estimating Illicit Financial Flows, A Critical Guide to the Data, Methodologies and Findings with Peter Jansky, and just published by Sage, What Do We Know and What Should We Do About Tax Justice? It is such an interesting discussion, and I'm sure you will learn as much as I did. Let's dive in. Hello, Alex. It's lovely to see you.
Hi, Marianne. Thanks very much for the invitation.
It's very exciting for me to have you on the podcast because you are an expert on finance and tax and everything that's going on in the kind of international monetary world. And this is a topic that I've been particularly obsessed with recently because I've realized how important it is to kind of just understanding so many of the other things that we do in our work at Justice Studio. So it's great to have you. It would be really good if you could just give us a bit about your background and just tell us how you began working on financial flows as a starter.
Sure. So look, I'm an economist, or I don't know, I was. And I suppose the first proper job I had was as a very junior researcher at Oxford University. And I worked on different things there, but one of them was writing background papers for what was then the first government white paper for which the new Department for International Development was the lead department. And for the first time, off the back of those background papers, we got language into a UK government thing about the damage that tax havens do to developing countries, the amount of revenues that are lost to the tax abuse of multinational companies and of individuals hiding their assets and income streams offshore. Now, it was literally a few paragraphs, and it was the first time I'd looked at it at all, but it just lit a flame. And so over the years, I've kind of bounced around between more NGO advocacy places and more research centres, but always more or less working on these issues, the impacts of tax or the failures of tax justice, in a sense, on our societies, both in high-income countries and lower-income countries, the kind of damage that does. And I suppose when, you know, in 2015, when I had the chance to actually take a job with the Tax Justice Network, which I kind of worked with as part of the wider network for quite a long time before that, it just seemed like the right place. The combination of research and advocacy into these issues and a platform to really try to change the world.
Amazing. That's very exciting that you were there at the beginning of the Department for International Development, which is such an institution, and we've worked for them in the past, but of course now they have been subsumed into the Foreign Office and now they're the FCDO. So that's a shame, but it's nice that you were there at the beginning and trying to make these important issues more acknowledged. I don't know how many people know about tax justice. For me, it was a relatively recent discovery. But it would be great if you could help to just define what tax justice is, and also maybe just explain a bit about what the Tax Justice Network does as well.
Sure. Tax justice. I think often people's first reaction to tax can be that it's something that sort of is annoying, that it's money they have to give away. And so the idea of combining tax and justice perhaps doesn't necessarily immediately make sense to people, or certainly it didn't 20 years ago. But I think we've started to create this space now. So, you know, you can think of a narrower and a broader definition. The narrow definition would be something like, you know, putting an end to the tax abuse of multinational companies and very wealthy individuals who manage to hide themselves somehow from the tax system while the rest of us are paying what we should. They're able to escape one way or another. But look, a broader definition would recognize that tax is really our social superpower, right? Tax, we may think it's this kind of funny and or annoying technical thing, but it's absolutely at the core of how we organize ourselves as societies. So instead of living, you know, as Thomas Hobbes might have put it, you know, short, nasty, brutal, brutish, solitary lives, we can choose to live longer, healthier, better lives together in societies. And one of the key ways we do that is through tax. So tax allows us to raise, you know, this is what we call the four R's. It allows us to raise revenues to pay for public services, inclusive, universal public services that we all benefit from. It also allows us to ensure that we have redistribution to reduce the greatest inequalities, both at the top end and the bottom end of the distribution. It allows us to reprice things like tobacco consumption, where private consumption decisions have major public and social health impacts, or carbon emissions. If we can't tax carbon emissions effectively, we're losing one of the main tools that we have to stop the kind of damage that we're doing to the planet. And then the fourth R is the one that we tend to overlook, and that's representation. So it turns out that the share of tax in government spending is one of the only things that's really consistently associated with improvements in governance. When governments rely more on tax, they are also less corrupt. They are more accountable to their citizens, their taxpayers, and the public services that they deliver with the money they spend turn out to be more inclusive and more effective. Things like public health are actually much more effective when they're more largely funded by tax as opposed to other sources of money. So it isn't just having another pound, another dollar, another euro. It's the quality of that money. When it comes from tax, it actually delivers better results even for the same amount of money. So for that reason, we say, you know, tax is our social superpower. And when we get it right, when everyone effectively is paying the tax they should be paying in the place where they should be paying it, we all get to live better lives. How about that?
I mean, that does sound better, doesn't it? I think this is the thing, that tax historically hasn't been considered very sexy or glamorous. It's kind of one of those things that seems to happen behind closed doors in enactuary places or whatever. And it often isn't necessarily associated with more kind of exciting social justice, but actually it's really massively key, isn't it? And I think just simply acknowledging, which I think a lot of people can, that there are certain people who have a lot of wealth and don't pay tax because of the way that tax is structured, and it is the poorer people who seem to be paying tax, and there are so many more complicated things that we're going to go into in this episode. But can you just tell me briefly what the Tax Justice Network does? And what your mission is?
Sure. So our mission really is to deliver tax justice, which is a bit tautological, I realise. But, you know, we're kind of an independent international organisation that is really focused on making sure both that the public narratives about tax are shifted to recognise the importance of it, to enable the other piece we do, which is delivering the policy solutions. Often, you know, tax can be very technical, and so we're accountants and lawyers and economists and human rights specialists working together in different countries around the world in order to have the best kind of set of policy analysis of the data, of which countries are most responsible for tax abuse, operating either as corporate tax havens or as financial secrecy jurisdictions. And secrecy turns out to be key in this space. When one jurisdiction creates a veil of secrecy, it allows all sorts of tax abuse and corruption to happen in other countries. And so we have to understand the kind of extraterritorial responsibilities that each country has in contributing to either global progress or, unfortunately, often the opposite. And so our work analyzes all of that, the revenue losses that each country suffers, that each country is responsible for inflicting on others, the secrecy and the focus on corporate profit shifting that enables multinationals' tax abuse, all of that kind of more technical side, if you like, but as part of a global movement. And so we work very closely with the Global Alliance for Tax Justice, which is the umbrella body for mass mobilization organizations with regional networks all around the world. And so between these two pieces, the mass mobilization and the technical and high-level communications work, there's this really powerful movement that's grown up since Tax Justice Network was established in 2003 into, you know, what really is now a powerful global movement. We're not there yet, but we have tools now, and we have a platform from which we are starting to change the world in the right direction.
Amazing. I think it's really interesting because in a way I feel like a lot of the stuff that we've done at Justice Studio, or in general as in social justice, it feels more tangible in the sense that you can see it. But with a lot of the financial injustice that goes on, a lot of it feels secret, and it's almost like another layer of something happening that a lot of us in working in other areas of social justice can't see. We see the effects of it, but we can't actually see kind of how it's moving around. And what really interests me and excites me about this is just trying to almost like take away that layer of secrecy of stuff that's happening that most ordinary people wouldn't see. And I know you've written, you know, many books, but you talk about illicit financial flows and things like that. And this is partly what I think is this network that's going on that we can't really see. But it would be great if you could explain a little bit about, you know, why do you talk about illicit financial flows and what are they?
Sure. So illicit financial flows is an umbrella term that was really kind of came to prominence in the mid-2000s. It was an organization in the United States called Global Financial Integrity, led by Raymond Baker, who was an American businessman who'd worked in Nigeria and other places. And he'd seen this sort of corruption that, you know, that he considered in terms of the financial flows across borders that are partly hidden or completely hidden. But he was aware that the common way of talking about corruption in those days was, you know, if you think about the Corruption Perceptions Index, it's always the poorest countries, the countries with the lowest per capita incomes, that get the worst scores. Yeah. And so you get this idea that corruption is about the poor countries, that poor countries are corrupt, if you like. Yeah. And he really, you know, he understood as an American businessman operating in Nigeria that actually that was really looking down the wrong end of the telescope. So he could see that all of the stripping out of profit in order not to pay tax in Nigeria and other countries where he worked was really of a piece with, but also much bigger than, the type of things we think of as corruption, the kind of the theft of state assets by kleptocrats, for example. And so he wanted to put this all together, to get people to understand that if you're concerned about that kind of theft of state assets, if you're concerned about the laundering of the proceeds of crime, that's proceeds of drug trafficking or environmental trafficking or human trafficking, if you're concerned about corruption that stops markets working because people hide their true ownership in order to hide a monopoly position, for example, or to get contracts when actually they've got people from government working on their side, all of that stuff is really made possible by exactly the same mechanisms as the tax abuse of multinational companies and of individuals when they hide their assets and their income streams offshore. So this umbrella term, illicit financial flows, is to capture all of that, all of these hidden or semi-hidden financial flows, most of which, but not all of which, are explicitly illegal. And he was very deliberate to include the kind of the tax avoidance of multinational companies, which can be, isn't always legal, but it can be legal. Very often, though, it just doesn't get challenged in court. So we never really know. They get away with it. But in any case, the effect is the same. It strips out what would have been resources available in the country where the real economic activity took place. And it works in such a way that it undermines the quality of governance, as well as taking away the money. And what it relies on, what each of these different types of illicit financial flow rely on, is financial secrecy. You have to be able to hide the ownership of a company or a bank account or some other kind of legal vehicle. You have to be able to hide the flows either by hiding the value of trade, commodity trade, for example, or hiding the transaction that's taking place in financial markets, hiding who the people are behind it in order to get your profits, your capital gains, your income, your wealth out of one jurisdiction where you should pay tax or you should be regulated and into another one. So that's really the idea. And it gathered steam through the late 2000s until famously the high-level African panel on illicit financial flows out of Africa, which was chaired by the former South African president, Thabo Mbeki. And the Mbeki panel really put together for the first time a consistent regional analysis of the damage being done by illicit flows to Africa. The scale of it, which I think they estimated at least $50 billion a year. And they made the point that it's much, much bigger than the aid inflows that African countries collectively received. And this created the basis for when the Sustainable Development Goals were created in 2015, the set of targets for the world, as it were, there was a target for the first time ever to curb illicit financial flows. And that's really, you know, to the credit of the Mbeki panel.
Amazing. That's so interesting. I always used to frustrate me a lot when I would have, when you'd look at those kind of corruption databases and people would say that certain poorer countries were much more corrupt and, you know, like, oh, Britain and America, we're not corrupt at all. And it just never really rung quite true for me because, you know, you know that there's all sorts of different things happening, but as you say, so much of it is secret and so much of it is in the structures and how it's all been set up in favor of certain countries rather than other countries but it is so much harder to identify. It's not like, you know, just you can't see it on the road as easily or whatever, you know, with a policeman kind of asking for money or whatever. It's a different kind of thing, but no less destructive, in fact, much more destructive. And the fact that we can't see it as an ordinary people can mean that we find it more difficult to challenge. So it's so important. And I'm again, just very grateful that you're on here to explain about it more. This has a big history, and I am really obsessed with history anyway. And I do think it's really important for us to understand where we got to today by acknowledging the history. So it would be great if you could explain kind of how we got here. What is the history of tax and these kind of important things have changed throughout the world to bring us to the point where we are today?
I mean, I have to say, I find the history fascinating, and, you know, perhaps one day when I put down my advocacy hat, I'll go back and get stuck into the research on this again. Because I think the way this has developed over centuries is really kind of fundamental to understanding the world that we live in today, not just for the immediate fight for tax justice, but actually in much broader ways too. So that we've tended to talk about there being three imperial ages of illicit financial flows. And that's really just to make a point, in a sense, that this is such a long-term process. It's not just the last few decades or something. So the first age is the age of formal empire, right? So where a set of countries, including Britain, you know, develop these international empires largely through their very effective use of violence and the threat of violence. And in that process, what's going on really is that they're going into one country after another, taking either the resources that they can remove or the rights to use and access the resources that are fixed in place, including people, of course, but also natural resource wealth in enormous values. Now, sometimes that's done almost as a simple military action, but very often, because it's a long-term process in most cases, it actually has a significant element that's about tax. So whether that's charter companies like the East India Company being given the right to levy taxes in large parts of what's now India, for example, effectively in order to pay Indian manufacturers and farmers, producers, for their own output to then sell it on the international market. So effectively taxing them in order that the East India Company wouldn't actually have to pay for the stuff they were taking. Or it's local administrations set up by the British and other empires taking for themselves taxing rights, again through the threat of violence, in order to make the local population pay for the cost of being administered by empire. So in both cases, tax is one of the mechanisms, and probably the central mechanism, that extracts directly the finances alongside the much broader economic extraction that's going on. So we can think of that as the first imperial age of illicit financial flows. And it's that taking through economic extraction that then continues into the second age. And this is a more interesting one where, in some sense, we haven't thought about this as much, I think, especially in Britain. And this is as formal empire begins to come to an end, what happens is you have countries becoming independent, or the threat, as it's perceived, that they could become independent. And the people and the companies that have made so much money through economic extraction under empire become increasingly concerned that they might be expropriated, or rather reappropriated by those newly independent states, that they might take back what's been extracted under empire. So they're worried about getting the ownership of their assets and income streams out of colonies and former colonies. At the same time, back in the metropolis, including in Britain, but a set of other imperial capitals also, you've got governments introducing significant income taxes and in some cases wealth taxes, not quite for the first time, but certainly the first time in several decades, because they're about to launch into a series of wars with each other and they need the money.
You're talking the beginning of 20th century, or mid 20th century, kind of around that time?
Yeah. So you can see little pieces of this really from the end of the 19th century, mm-hmm. Some key cases where, for example, a famous case with a British company based in Egypt, where you're starting to see people, lawyers really, at this stage primarily, seeing what they can get away with in terms of separating assets and income streams from the taxing power of empire. And so in this second stage, people are really looking for some way to take what they've illicitly removed under formal empire, but not put it back in the metropolis where they might have to pay tax. So they're, in a sense, they're facing a twin threat as they see it. In order to keep their ill-gotten gains away from everyone, they need somewhere else to go. This is what Vanessa Ogle, a really wonderful historian, calls funk money, because the people who've got these illicitly gained assets are really in a funk. They're frightened. They're running from both sides. And this is when we start to see what we now think of as tax havens. Smaller jurisdictions within empire, but under the same legal system. And that's the crucial feature, particularly where they're under the British legal system, that realize, or rather are encouraged by various lawyers and others, that if they offer a certain type of product, a certain type of legal vehicle or banking services, they can really benefit significantly from this. And these are typically very small places, small islands normally, with small populations, where if they're able to take just a very, very small service charge, in effect, for creating a place of safety for this illicit money, then suddenly they're doing very well financially. So it's in their interest, and it's in the interest of the people who want to keep their illicit assets out of the hands of any state that might come looking for them. And so in this second stage, we get this development of what later become tax havens. And over time, so from around the 1920s through to the 50s, this is a slowly developing process across empires, but especially in the British Empire. And it's really probably not till about 1960, you'd say, we can enter in what we're in now, this third period that we could call tax haven empire, if you like. So the age of formal empire is largely behind us, although, of course, we live with a great deal of it still, and some would say we're still living under a form of empire, at least in terms of tax havenry. I'd certainly say that's true, because what's happened is that increasingly the globalization that we're familiar with doesn't have, you know, tax havens or financial secrecy jurisdictions as, you know, in a sense, very small marginal players at the side. They and the associated tax practices of multinational companies and international banks with wealthy clients are absolutely at the heart. They're at the core of the global economy. So these practices are really central to what we consider this age of globalization. Very rare indeed, if not extinct, is the multinational company that does not run some of its profits through a jurisdiction where it has little or no real economic activity in order to pay less tax in some of the places where it has real economic activity, where it employs people, where it makes sales. And few, if any, are the banking systems that are not exposed to the stripping out of finances of different kinds away from the places where the individuals with that wealth and those income streams are based for tax purposes in order to hide it somewhere else. And that's really, you know, just the consistent feature of the global economy and global finance. But as you've said a couple of times now, and I think it's such an important point, this is different from something like, you know, thinking about trade justice. Are different countries getting a fair price? Are farmers getting a fair price? Which is much more tangible, much easier to see. You know what you pay for a banana, and you can be told fairly easily how much of that's going to the farmer in whichever country it may be. The same type of breaking down, stripping out of the value is much harder to see when it's in a bigger multinational supply chain with something that probably isn't a tangible commodity that you can hold in your hand. And so it's taken longer, I think, for tax justice campaigning to really take off globally in the way that trade justice campaigning did a few decades ago. We're on that road now, though. And I think the more that all of us understand the very long process that's got us to where we are now, the better we can understand this moment and the better we can make sure that we're making the changes that we need to unravel all of the damage that this does to all of us. I realise I should have said, you know, our estimates are that the tax abuse, this type of cross-border tax abuse, costs the world something in the region of $480 billion a year, and that's $500 billion. The underlying illicit financial flows that make that possible are in the many trillions of dollars a year. Now, that means with a global economy that's probably a bit less than $100 trillion, we're talking about something that in an accounting sense is material. The distortions in our global economic accounts are sufficiently large that an accountant probably wouldn't sign off that set of accounts, because what we think we understand is so far from the underlying reality. That's how big these things are. It's how bad a problem they are, purely in the financial terms. When we convert that into the kind of damage that it does to all of our societies, the lost health, the lost quality of government, you know, the lost lives, because this converts directly into excess child mortality, maternal mortality, and so on. All of that damage has been largely hidden up to now.
Yeah, it's so important, isn't it? And I think that's the thing. It's like, it's just this fact that you can't see it. The more I'm learning about it, and I'm such at a beginner's stage in understanding all of this, the more it upsets me. I mean, I remember once just thinking, oh yeah, tax havens. Oh yeah, rich people put their thing in tax havens. But, and I knew it was a kind of like a problem, but I didn't really understand exactly how much that actually was a problem for, you know, our countries, because basically it does mean, doesn't it, that whereas in an ideal sense, the money that's earned from companies or whatever will get then reinvested into the local economy. People will be buying things there, you know, workers will have better wages, there'll be, you know, better healthcare and all this stuff, and all the money will be circulating and helping to grow the economy. When you've got tax havens, it's just like everything's being sucked out like a Hoover, just kind of sucking the wealth and then hiding it in these little boxes away from everybody. And the money can't do any good there. It's just literally stagnating and being hoarded. So like the more I think of it in these ways, it just seems so wrong.
Defenders of tax havenry would say, well, that's not really true, because the money may park briefly in a tax haven, but then it goes out very, very efficiently back into the global economy. And that is true to a point, but it's also true that once you've stripped your profits out of a given country, it can be problematic to take them back in, or problematic in the sense that you might actually have to pay some tax. So the system does actually militate against consistent investment within particularly lower income countries that are the most exposed to this type of tax abuse. So that kind of distortion does work against economically productive investments, as well as just the stripping out of the revenues themselves. And then on top of that, you think, you know, this is a global industry. The number of lawyers and accountants and other tax professionals and advisors who really waste their lives on things that have literally no productive value and at the same time do significant damage. You know, some of the best minds, as it were, of our generation and the last generation and the one to come, if we don't stop this, are just going to go and spend 30, 40, 50 years helping companies and individuals not pay the tax that they should. And all of their time and energy and all of the legal vehicles that they create and all of the lobbying that they do of governments and all of the, you know, the time they spend thinking about ways to game the system, all of that's wasted. You know, at best, it's a deadweight loss for society. And at worst, it's actually significantly worse than that. It imposes great costs. How are we organizing ourselves as human beings if this is the kind of the best thing that we can think to pay people to do? We're wildly off beam from any kind of idea of living together well. You know, if aliens ever come and have a look at us, they must just, you know, I don't know if they laugh in their sleeves or they cry and they go away again thinking this species is not ready for progress, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, our values are just so skewed, or especially the values that mean that we spend all of this time, yeah, trying to hide wealth, I guess, rather than helping the world to be a better, nicer place to live in and, you know, enjoying things. It does seem so illogical and anti-human, really, doesn't it? Are you able to just tell us how tax havens actually operate then? Like, what do they do for the lay person like me that isn't necessarily an economist?
So there's a couple of things that they're doing, really. But the first thing to say is just that we all have an image in our head of tax havens, and it's wrong, right? Still now, every time or almost every time you see a kind of a major international newspaper with an article about tax havens, they have a picture of an island with palm trees on it. Mm. And this is just wrong. And it's, you know, it's wrong in a way that's unhelpful. And at some level, as Professor Stephen Dean from Brooklyn Law in the States has called out, it's effectively racist as well. Because we say, look, there are these small islands, mainly majority black, that are really, these are the tax havens doing damage to the rest of us. And in fact, that's almost the opposite of what our analysis shows. So look, tax havens, there are two types of things to think about. One is a corporate tax haven. And this is somewhere that deliberately creates conditions that are attractive and facilitate profit shifting by multinationals. So the multinational, you know, does its production in Brazil and its final sales in France, but it ends up with all its profits in the Netherlands, let's say, as is often the case. The Netherlands is offering conditions that are really attractive for the multinational in terms of the treaties that it might have with Brazil and France that enable it to sort of protect the profit once it's there from claims of tax from either side, and a degree of secrecy that makes it hard for the tax authorities or the public at either end of the chain to see what's happening in the Netherlands. So secrecy is key, but it needs a bit more than that. You need very low or zero effective tax rates and ways to make sure that that's applied to profit that was actually earned somewhere else. So that's the corporate tax haven model. And, you know, we have a corporate tax haven index that looks at the extent to which countries and jurisdictions have gone to the extreme to offer those conditions. And we use that coupled with the scale of the activity of each of those jurisdictions to rank them globally in terms of the damage that they do. Now, there you do see some small islands with palm trees, like the Cayman Islands is one of the most damaging corporate tax havens in the world. But you see a lot of OECD countries as well, like the Netherlands, like Luxembourg, like Ireland, like Switzerland. So we shouldn't think of those small islands as being the villains here.
Is the City of London a tax haven?
This is a great question. I mean, yes, is the answer. It's a tax haven as a corporate tax haven, but it's also a tax haven the other sort, which is probably a bigger part of the problem in some ways, because it's a broader type of tax havenry. And this is what we call a financial secrecy jurisdiction. Now, these offer low or zero effective tax rates as well for individuals, often not only for companies, but they also offer a much wider range of financial secrecy. And that's secrecy about, you know, who owns a company set up there, or a trust or a foundation or a bank account. It's secrecy in terms of refusing to share information with other countries, law enforcement agencies or tax authorities. Secrecy in terms of not publishing the results of tax cases in courts, and a whole set of other areas where you don't require any kind of public disclosures at all. Now, on that, the UK itself, and the City of London in particular, is very definitely one of the big players. But again, you know, what we see is this pattern. There are small palm tree islands that play a bit of a role in this game, but the big global players are actually the big economies. Jurisdiction number one on the Financial Secrecy Index, by a distance, is the United States. And one of the reasons for that is the United States is the only major financial center that refuses to provide information to any other country about the financial accounts that their tax residents have in the United States. And the US does this at the same time as it demands that every other country's financial institutions provide that information to it about any US citizen or tax resident who has a bank account offshore. So it's this completely one-sided, effectively hypocritical choice. You know, somebody has a book called The Hypocritical Hegemon about the United States and its financial secrecy. But the United States isn't the biggest player overall, because whether you're looking at corporate tax havenry or financial secrecy, or if you look at our State of Tax Justice report, which is where we do the estimates on which countries suffer revenue losses or impose revenue losses on other countries, in all three of those ways of looking at this problem, if you take the UK together with its dependent territories, you find it is the biggest single actor in all of these ways. It does the most damage to other countries. I think it imposes $189 billion of tax losses every year on other countries. It is responsible for the greatest risks posed by financial secrecy, giving rise not just to tax abuse, but all these types of illicit financial flows, corruption and so on, crime suffered by other countries. And it's responsible for the greatest threat of corporate tax havenry, corporate tax abuse. So the UK really is absolutely at the centre of all of these problems. And as I say, it stems from its past in terms of formal empire. Not enough of that, if you like, has gone away. And so the UK has a uniquely large responsibility for the problem of illicit financial flows around the world.
Wow. And within the UK, is there a more specific place? I'm just wondering, is it the City of London within, or is it our whole government that is where do we need to make the change or shine the light?
Good point. I mean, you know, the City of London is sort of, from a historical legal perspective, is a fascinating place, arguably sort of the first special economic zone that, you know, going back to kings of old, got its legal status separate from the rest of England and then the rest of the UK. And it used that in some ways to create some of the conditions that you can recognise in modern tax havenry. So that's definitely part of the issue and part of what's driven, you know, the City of London Corporation has lobbied for many decades for other jurisdictions to become tax havens. And it kind of goes around the world promoting effectively this race to the bottom in terms of transparency and regulatory standards, while proclaiming itself as the great flag bearer for high standards and the stock market and so on. So it's kind of central over centuries, really, to how UK, English, and then British politics have been distorted by the power of finance. And one of the effects, only one of the effects of that, has been to give very strong encouragement during this development from formal empire to tax haven empire for the British government to either actively encourage or at least not stand in the way of these smaller dependent territories becoming tax havens and secrecy jurisdictions. So you can trace that line. You know, there's a period, my former colleague Nick Shackson has a book called Treasure Islands that really goes into this. He went through the archives of the British government and he finds in the 50s and 60s this kind of dispute within the British government where on the one hand, you know, you have the UK Treasury, for example, is very concerned that these dependent territories are going to require it to provide large amounts of aid into the almost infinite future, if it's not just to abandon people to very poor lives. While at the same time, and so it's seeing this, you know, when it's approached by lawyers and others and saying, look, they could be a great tax haven, it's seeing the opportunities there to sort of to get them off the aid books, if you like. But then you've got the Bank of England saying, if you let this happen, the quote, financial wizards might run wild, right? And they won't just be doing damage to the rest of the world. They'll be doing damage to us here in the UK. So, no, we can't let this happen. And then you've got the tax authority, the Inland Revenue, as was, saying, well, look, if it happens over there, you know, maybe that's okay, but we need to make absolutely certain that they're not threatening British tax revenues, right? So you can screw everybody else, right? As long as it doesn't do any damage to us here. And without there ever really being a firm policy decision, you know, different governments went back and forth a bit. Effectively, what happened was this kind of slow, not quite decision thing, which was basically just, you know, we'll kind of turn a blind eye, right? We won't stop them doing it. We won't really encourage them very hard. We certainly won't have a formal policy that this should happen, but we definitely won't stand in their way either. And that's really pretty much continued to today. The City of London is not unrelated to successive UK governments' unwillingness to require a raising of standards.
Wow. So fascinating and disturbing, isn't it? I think for ages I didn't even realise that the City of London was its own little jurisdiction and entity. I mean, I knew that it was called the City of London and that it was within London, but I didn't really properly understand that it was almost like a state within a state. And it's really, really fascinating. I need to know more about it. But yeah, and it's this ancient thing. You've mentioned already the problems that there were within illicit financial flows and aid. And I know that when I've worked within the aid industry and I've kind of been in different countries, I've really felt this of giving of one hand and taking away with the other hand, you know, kind of giving with aid and taking away with kind of trade quotas and all of these other things. Where I didn't necessarily know that there was all this tax stuff going on as well. Could you explain a bit more about like how this works, why these things are kind of running counter to each other?
Yeah, and I think that is a key dynamic to have in mind. And it's one that's, interestingly, is kind of now starting to unravel. I don't want to say I'm a sort of completely against aid, but aid has only ever been at best, I think, a sticking plaster. But I talked earlier about the four R's of tax justice. We've added a fifth R, and that's reparations. So if you think about the scale of what is owed by an imperial power like Britain, right, to its former colonies, you know, there's a calculation, you know, a pretty you know, robust estimate for India as of a few years ago by the Patnaiks, which is something like $45 trillion, not billion, trillion, is what the UK owes what is now India to make up for everything that it stole through violence and the threat of violence. Now, $45 trillion simply isn't an amount of money that the UK economy could ever give back, even if in a sense we said we don't care about people living in the UK now and what happens to their standard of living. The UK economy itself just simply couldn't come up with that money at all, even over quite a sustained period of time. So you have to think about measures that would allow you to pay back reparations over the type of period of time during which empire took advantage of its economic extraction. That means quite gradually. You'd be able, without, you know, taxing multinationals any more than once on their profits, you could have them taxed in such a way that you had this consistent annual additional revenue right going to former colonies, being paid in effect, but in a sort of very painless way by the former imperial powers. And we think this might be kind of the only way that you could get to the kind of scale of economic extraction that you could be able to reverse it at the scale necessary without making countries like the UK sort of economically impossible today. Aid creates dependencies of exactly the wrong sort. Now, this type of reparatory flow, because it goes through a government budget, has the potential to operate in a different way. It's fixed, guaranteed. It's not about your relationship with the aid donor. It's not that you have to be nice to them and keep them happy. This is what you are owed. It is what your citizens are owed and what they should hold you as the government accountable for. So it has at least the potential to be consistent with much stronger citizen-state relations with the social contract in a way that aid is not. As it is, though, aid is typically a small fraction of what's actually being illicitly removed through different forms of tax abuse and types of corruption, the theft of state assets, in which multinational companies and others, typically headquartered in the former imperial powers, are normally the main actors. So there may be corrupt public officials or politicians, but they tend not to be the drivers even of that type of corruption. And certainly the tax abuse is about these actors from outside, often from the countries giving aid with their other hand, that are taking much more in illicit flows. What we're seeing at the United Nations now is led by the Africa group, you know, countries that have typically been among the most aid dependent. They are refusing to bend to the demands of the aid donor countries in the OECD and accept that tax rules can be set at the OECD, and instead demanding that those rules be set at the United Nations in a forum that is globally inclusive. So this is the opportunity to win, to improve our governance all around the world, to improve the revenues that governments have, but also the quality of their spending and all of the other benefits that we get, the 4 or 5 R's of tax, when we do tax well, when we get rid of the international obstacles to tax justice, the gains are potentially enormous.
Would it be okay for you to just define these key players, the OECD? Why does it matter who they are?
Sure. So the OECD has been the key player. You know, the OECD was set up in 1960, was set up really to make sure that the UN couldn't do tax anymore. Mm-hmm. So the initial international tax rules were set by the League of Nations, which was effectively the club of imperial powers in the late 1920s and the early 1930s. But after the Second World War, the League of Nations was dissolved and the United Nations was created with the promise that it would be globally inclusive. Now, what happened? Well, you had a whole, you know, this is sort of the decades when a whole series of countries that had been colonies were able to reclaim their independence and then to become members of the United Nations. So very quickly, you had a dynamic at the United Nations that the rich countries, the former empires, couldn't control anymore because it was simple majority rules voting for most things. And as you had more and more newly independent countries, they could demand, and increasingly they did in the 50s and then 60s, that they wanted the right to regulate multinational companies, not just in terms of tax, but all of the other damage they did in all sorts of ways, including in natural resource sector and environmental damage. Now, all of those multinationals were headquartered in the high-income countries, who were not very happy about the idea that their actions in former colonies might start being regulated. You know, it was bad enough that these countries gained independence, but we're going to let them regulate our multinationals too. That's a step too far. So in 1960, out of what had been a sort of post-war European organization, they created the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, mainly Western European members to begin with. Over time, it's grown to include Japan and South Korea, a couple of Latin American countries, Colombia, Chile. So it's got, I think, 38 members now. And it sets the tax rules. Rather than letting the UN get further into that, they took that power and put it in the OECD. So the OECD sets the tax rules, which effectively become the tax rules for everyone, even if you're not an OECD member, not by hard law, but by soft law. If you want multinationals to operate well, you kind of have to abide by these rules or have a fight or have them threaten to withdraw their investment. So through the 70s, 80s, 90s, this becomes increasingly locked in. And of course, the 1990s is when multinational tax abuse really explodes. So in the 1990s, the early 1990s, you can see only about 5% of their global profits are being declared in countries other than where they have their real economic activity. So it's not nothing, but it's kind of marginal. By the end of the 1990s, it's already doubled to about 10% of their global profits. Roll forward to the early 2010s, and it's 25, 30% going on 40, and it keeps growing. And that's why now we are at the point where all of the members of the United Nations, that's the 190-something countries of the world, have formed an ad hoc committee at the UN, which is, as we speak, is agreeing the draft terms of reference for formal negotiations on a UN framework convention on tax. And this would be something like the Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC. So it will have a convention of the parties, a regular meeting of all the countries of the world to respond to new challenges, but in this case, in terms of international tax cooperation. So we're going to have some early protocols in the next couple of years that could deliver some real low-hanging fruit, you know, some really big transparency measures that cut through illicit financial flows, cut through the corruption and tax abuse. But we'll also have this framework body, which in the years to come will be able to negotiate transparently and democratically and inclusively all these things that the OECD is not, because it's a members club that operates behind closed doors, will be able to negotiate international tax rules that actually work, including working for lower income countries, for former colonies, for the first time ever. So about 100 years after the League of Nations took a whole set of decisions that have worked out pretty badly for humanity, we're going to go back at the UN. And that will be the first real chance for all the countries of the world, all the people of the world, to engage in this process of trying to get tax justice. It's exciting times.
Yes, definitely. And I'm trying not to feel cynical about whether or not people sign it and actually implement it.
Well, I hear your cynicism, and I think this is a very reasonable area to be cynical. You know, every time we've thought we had a breakthrough at the OECD, and a lot of the campaigning since Tax Justice Network was set up in 2003, certainly the first 10 years was really focused on the OECD because that's where the power was. Every time we've thought we had a breakthrough, they've been delivered through the OECD because it was the only game in town on tax and transparency at that stage. And all of them have been delivered in a way that has prevented, well, firstly, has prevented the benefits being nearly as big as they should have been, but secondly, and worse, has prevented the benefits being enjoyed by lower income countries outside the OECD. And that's really what I think tipped people over the edge. That coupled with the OECD's failure to fix the corporate tax rules. Even OECD members, who kind of appreciate that they have disproportionate power if they can keep things at the OECD and not go to the UN, even for a lot of them, the frustration with the OECD is now so great that they're willing to say, yeah, let's try the UN, let's try moving this. And I think that's also my response to your cynicism, because, you have at the UN a process, you've seen it in the climate change negotiations, you get big blockers like the United States. But whereas at the OECD, that's happening behind closed doors, at the UN, you can still do that, but it's in the public domain. So we've seen the United States called out in the climate change COPs for being the big obstacle and actually be shamed into shifting its position. So it doesn't guarantee you success to go to the UN and to do this transparently in front of the global public and in front of each other, but it gives you a chance. So look, let's be cynical. Let's keep kind of a suspicious mindset. Let's keep pushing, make sure we have all the transparency and accountability we can get, and let's keep holding our politicians' feet to the fire. But at least at the UN, we can do that. And that's the opportunity we have to seize now.
And so how would you see a world where there is tax justice? How would it be different from now?
If we fix things internationally, we have a fair division of taxing rights and we end all of the tax rules and practices that allow this enormous scale of tax abuse now. What it means at the national level is this. We can go back to having direct taxes, that's taxes on incomes, on profits, on capital gains, wealth, property, the taxes that are most salient to people, in fact, whereas things like VAT, we often don't realise quite how much we're paying. We can make those direct taxes, again, the absolute centre point of our tax systems. And that matters for a set of reasons. Firstly, it opens up the possibility of having significantly more revenues in a lot of countries to fund high quality, inclusive public services. So we can all live better lives, better education, better healthcare for our children, better roads and infrastructure, better government administration. Also, governments that are more responsive and less corrupt, because paying direct taxes turns out to be particularly important for that virtuous circle of accountable government. Also, these are the taxes that do most in terms of redistribution. So it's the best chance we've got of curbing these dramatic inequalities of income and wealth that we all live with, in particular to the benefit of people who are at the sharp end of intersecting inequalities. We know the households that do worst, that also pay the highest share of their incomes in tax because of things like VAT, are the low-income households that are disproportionately likely to be headed by women, disproportionately likely to include people living with disabilities, disproportionately likely to include nomadic populations, travellers, for example, in the UK, ethno-linguistic minorities and marginalised groups, all of those people disproportionately likely to be paying a higher share of their income in tax on an income that is disproportionately low. Flipping that, because we get tax justice from the international level downwards, is perhaps the biggest prize, because the effect of curbing those inequalities is that we will all live better lives. You can see this dramatically in the UK at the minute. As we've allowed those inequalities to widen over 10 or 15 years, we've seen life expectancy, healthy life expectancy most sharply, turn backwards for the first time in generations, right? Because we are poorer and we are more unequal, and it's inequality that's really driving that effect. Tax justice is the way that we can reverse that. And it's only slightly utopian, because the research is there to back all of these things. If we can fix these international abuses that undermine every government's ability to pursue direct taxes effectively, to deliver what we, I think, all want in our societies. So that's your tax justice vision. Come on in.
Amazing. Yeah, well, certainly it does seem that tax justice is the key for to solving inequality, or at least having a much better world and more, yeah, more equal. So, I definitely be on board for that. And thank you so much for talking about it. There is so much more to discuss. I feel like it's just such a rich issue in terms of all of the different layers and things to understand and interconnecting issues and players and things. But it's been amazing for you to shed light on this and just kind of give us a really good introduction and an overview. So thank you.
Thank you.
If people want to follow you or follow Tax Justice Network, how can they do that? How can they find you?
Well, so the website is taxjustice.net, and from there, you know, you can find all of the indexes I talked about, the reports on the state of tax justice, our kind of regular commentary on what's going on at the UN and the OECD and so on. And of course, we're on, you know, most social media, including the bad ones. Normally taxjustice.net is the handle. So yeah, come and find us, get involved. Please also, you know, look at our great allies at the Global Alliance for Tax Justice. You know, they say governments and politicians don't see the light, they feel the heat. It's when we create some heat together that we get progress on tax justice. So that's the opportunity. Get involved, make some heat.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It's been really, really brilliant to have you. I really appreciate your time.
No, look, thank you so much for the opportunity. And, you know, I hope people will hear this and get engaged. And look, good luck to you for all the work you're doing at Justice Studios. I have become a listener to the podcast now, and I'm, you know, kind of fascinated to hear the range that you cover and the different aspects of justice. It's great. So, look, thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very exciting. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Justice Studio Sessions. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. Justice Studio provides compassionate consultancy rooted in social justice. If you would like to work with us, please visit our website at www.justicestudio.org or email us at info@justicestudio.org. This podcast relies on your support. If you love our content and would like to see this podcast reach more people, please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating or leave us a lovely review. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow Marianne at creatrix.london and Justice Studio at Justice Studio on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted by Marianne Moore and produced by Justice Studio Limited. The music was by Luke Fraser at The Tonic, and the artwork was by Marianne. Thank you so much for listening.